1 Kings 18 tells the amazing story of the prophet Elijah and the victory that is given over the prophets of Baal. In that chapter, the prophet Elijah single-handedly faces false religion in the northern kingdom. Religion that had been encouraged and maintained, sustained by Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel. In the end of that chapter, rain once again falls on a land that has had no rain for years. But chapter 19 begins with a message from Jezebel for the prophet Elijah. You're a dead man. I'm going to make you like all of the prophets of Baal who were executed there in the vicinity of Mount Carmel. And an amazing transformation comes over the prophet Elijah. The man who stood up and challenged the people of Israel, choose who you will serve this day, and who mocked Baal, runs scared from the wicked queen Jezebel. Lest we be too hard on Elijah, she had already killed many of the prophets of God. She was cleansing the land of true religion, of the worship of Jehovah God, so that Baal worship would be all that was left over. And Elijah is so clearly discouraged in chapter 19 of 1 Kings. Perhaps you've already turned there. Let's note just a verse or two in the first 10 verses of that chapter. 1 Kings chapter 19 and in verse 3. When Elijah heard the message of Jezebel, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. So he flees from the northern kingdom to the southern kingdom of Judah and to the south part of Judah. Left his servant there in Beersheba, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die and said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my fathers." Elijah is ready to die. Asks the Lord to take him. Of course, what we understand is that with time, the Lord recommissions him and finds an assistant to Elijah, Elisha, as you'll read about in successive chapters. Many of God's servants at times fell into the same kind of discouragement, even fear sometimes, that Elijah experiences here in the beginning of chapter 19. Turn in your Old Testaments to the Psalms, specifically to the 55th Psalm, a Psalm of David. Listen to what David writes in Psalm 55, beginning in verse 1. He says, "Give ear to my prayer, O God, and do not hide yourself from my supplication. Attend to me and hear me. I am restless in my complaint and moan noisily because of the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked, for they bring down trouble upon me, and in wrath they hate me." David is pained because he's being persecuted, he's being opposed, attacked by an enemy. Verse 4, "My heart is severely pained within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling have come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. So I said, 'Oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. Indeed, I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness. I would hasten my escape from the windy storm and tempest.'" Now drop down to verse 12, if you will, and let's fill in a couple more details about the circumstances of David at this point. Verse 12, "For it is not an enemy who reproaches me. Then I could bear it. nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me. Then I could hide from him, but it was you, a man, my equal, my companion, and my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked to the house of God in the throng." David says, it's not my enemy, it's not somebody who hates me, it's somebody I've been close to, my friend who now has turned against me. And David is discouraged. You can read it in the language of the psalm. The prophet Jeremiah is sometimes known as the weeping prophet because of his own emotions as he prophesied the doom, the destruction of the southern kingdom. One of my favorite passages in the book of Jeremiah is the beginning of chapter 9. It's almost amusing, were it not sad. In chapter 9 and verse 1, listen to the words of Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, "Oh, that my head were waters, and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people." Jeremiah says, "Oh, I just wish there was some way I could just weep interminably for all of the people of my, all the people of the nation who have died." But now in the very next verse, listen to what he says. "Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place for travelers, that I might leave my people and go from them, for they're all adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men." Jeremiah's got a problem. On the one hand, he's distraught about what's happening to the nation. That's his nation. Those are his people, his countrymen, and they're being destroyed, as Jeremiah witnessed himself. But on the other hand, he knows what they've been up to. He knows what kind of people they are, and he's just as distraught about that. Talk about discouragement. There's no place to go. Whichever way you lean, it is nothing but discouragement. I think everyone is subject to discouragement at least occasionally. There are some of us who are a little more chipper than others. But I think even those, at times, because of circumstances in their lives, will feel and have felt discouragement. I've entitled tonight's sermon, Peaks and Valleys. Have you ever noticed that you can't have two peaks without a valley in between? It is a logistical axiom. If you are traversing the mountains, in order for you to cross from one mountain to the other, it may not be a deep valley, it may be a tremendous gorge, but there's always a valley between the peaks. If you can think of the peaks in your life as those times when you are, let's say, up, when you are encouraged and you feel invigorated spiritually, the times when you feel like you could take on Satan and all of his angels with one hand tied behind your back, that's a peak. And those valleys are the times when you feel like David said, "I'm a worm. Why do you even pay attention to me? I can't understand why it is I keep sometimes making the same mistakes. Why is it that I seem to be so weak? Why is it that everything's against me?" Those are the valleys, and you are going to have both of them. You can't have the peaks without having the valleys. It is a geographical truism. It is a truism of life. How a person deals with the setbacks of life is a better indicator of strength and character than how they deal with the times of success. Valleys do not have to destroy us. They will come. There will be discouragement. But we don't have to be destroyed by those periods of discouragement. We can climb for the next peak. But I will tell you, what you do in the valley will say a lot more about you as a person than how you behave on the peak. Because it's easy to be strong when you're at the top of the world. It's more difficult to persevere when you're at the bottom looking up. So tonight, let's talk a little bit about discouragement. And lest I discourage you, I intend to try to stop on time tonight. I want to talk to you about some causes of discouragement besides long sermons. I want to talk to you about the danger of discouragement. But my motivation, my objective primarily, is to discuss how you and I can overcome discouragement. And I'm going to suggest four prospective points. I should say perspective points, excuse me. And we'll close the sermon by discussing those points. Let me talk to you about some of the causes of discouragement. And I probably don't even have to go over this list. Most of you could compile it, probably from some of your own experiences. Hopefully not all of these. But sometimes we're discouraged because of relationship problems. Marriages, even good marriages, sometimes pass through periods of difficulty. Sometimes money is a problem. How you're going to spend it? When will there be enough? Who's going to spend what? Sometimes there are intimacy problems, adjustments that are not always made very well in the physical demands between a husband and wife. In-laws can cause discouragement. Not my in-laws. I'm talking about all the other in-laws. Since my in-laws are sitting right up here in the front. For those of you who don't know. But in-laws sometimes are a cause of discouragement because they meddle and they fiddle in other people's relationships. Sometimes there are personality conflicts in various relationships, even within the marriage relationship. Sometimes there's problems with children, misbehavior. You ever had to knock your kids' heads together because they wouldn't play nice? Yeah, like every day. That causes discouragement. The stories I could tell you, especially since Jonathan and David are not here and we'll never know. But we used to tell them, you were named David and Jonathan because in the Bible they were the best of friends. Their souls were, as the Bible says in the King James Version, knit together. And you will be knit together or we'll knock your heads together. And we had to do that sometimes. But I'll tell you, it's discouraging when they don't seem to want to get along. Wait till they go to college. Sometimes it doesn't get any better. Sometimes we're discouraged because of relationships with people outside of our family, with friends, friends who betray you. I think that's what David was writing about. I think that's why the pain was so deep and sharp, was because it wasn't his enemy. It wasn't the one who, you know, openly hated him. It was the one he trusted. It was the one that was close to him. Those are the ones that can hurt you the most and discourage you the most. I can withstand character assassination from all kinds of people who I know don't like me. It's the one that I thought that liked me. That when he or she writes lies about me, that's really the one that hurts me. And that's discouraging sometimes. The friends who have no time for you. You want to spend time with them. You want to develop your relationship and they're too busy. And that can be discouraging. Sometimes there are problems with material matters. Job setbacks. Anybody here ever had a job setback? Thought you were doing well and your employer had an entirely different perception of your abilities and your work? Disappointments because you missed a promotion and a guy who can't tie his shoes got it? Disappointments because you didn't get the pay raise you're expecting? Lack of appreciation from people for the work that you've done, that's very discouraging. If you put your all, as you should as a Christian, into your employment, working, serving as to the Lord, and it just all is taken for granted, that can be discouraging. You're plodding along and there seems to be no end, no reward. Financial difficulties, costs are rising faster than your income. The business, if you're a business owner, slows down and all of a sudden, the income's just not there. What do? You can be very discouraged by those things. I think sometimes people are discouraged because of fatigue and physical illness. I'm going to be 45 this year. I remember when 45 was ancient. I thought my parents would probably pass away at that age. 45. I can't do what I could do when I was 20. Don't tell Deb that. She still thinks I can work like a horse. But as you get older, you come to realize that your physical powers are not what they used to be. And that can be discouraging if you'll let it. Physical illness is sometimes discouraging. That of our own body, or even others whom we cherish and we see their bodies deteriorating with age and use. And that's discouraging to us because we know that the end will come, both for them and for us. I think it's easier to become discouraged when we're physically fatigued. And our fast-paced lifestyle, as I suggested this morning, makes that fact even more relevant than it was in times past. Life moves faster. You don't get out of the way, you get run over. And that can be it can be fatiguing, and that fatigue sets us up for illness, it sets us up for discouragement. And I will tell you that long and debilitating illnesses are discouraging. If you can walk well, then give thanks to God. If you are able to read what you want to read, then give thanks to God. There are people who can't. And I could go down the list of all of the various physical capacities that you have and that we take for granted, and I can tell you there's somebody who would kill for what you have. It can be discouraging when you can't do for yourself what in days past you did for others. Sometimes I think we're discouraged by our own spiritual failures. There are some people who never seem to realize that they have been failing spiritually. But for those who examine their own lives and are cognizant of what the standard is, discouragement sometimes arises because of our own moral battles. The man or the woman who struggles with lustful thoughts and can't seem to get the handle on things. Laziness, cruel and biting speech, honesty. A lie comes out of my mouth before I know what's going on. Seems. And we can be discouraged because we're not making progress like we'd like to make. Sometimes it's not our own spiritual failures that discourage us. Sometimes it's the spiritual failures of the people around us. We need to be careful about being too hard on our judgment. But at the same time, I have been a part of congregations where I will tell you it was discouraging. Because people that I knew ought to know better didn't seem to know better. People that I expected conduct that was appropriate for Christians, for new creatures in Christ, behaved in fashions that were entirely carnal and worldly. And that's discouraging. You expect that out of the world. You don't expect it out of brothers and sisters. And when that happens in their lives, it is much more discouraging than when you read about it on the news or see it in the neighborhood where you live. Apathy among fellow members is very discouraging, and particularly for new Christians who come into this relationship with Jesus Christ all on fire. They are excited about the blessings that they have. I appreciate Wally's comment about understanding how blessed we are spiritually so that we are even more motivated, inclined to share those blessings with others. I think that's an important perspective as I thought about what he had to say. And here's the new Christian who wants to tell everybody, who thinks everybody ought to be as excited about the gospel as he or she is, and they're in the group of Christians who in some cases are just plain dead spiritually. They haven't talked to anybody about the gospel in years. Don't intend to. And that can be extremely discouraging. I've worked with congregations where, I will be frank with you, I talk to people and teach people, and it scares me to death to bring them to be with the brethren. That's a hard thing to say. It is the truth. Because I knew what the result would be. I knew what they would see. And I knew it would be discouraging. What do? Worship services seem to be flat and uninteresting in some places. I will tell you, I don't have that problem here. I hope you don't either. I don't know why you would. I think the worship here is done well. Numerical growth is non-existent. In fact, it may be that the church just keeps getting smaller, a little bit smaller each year. They're losing ground because nobody's being added. They're just dying or leaving, falling away in some cases. And that's discouraging. It is hard to stay on the peak when you see those kinds of conditions among the people that are your spiritual family, the local congregation with which you worship. And I will tell you something else that we can probably gain from the story of Elijah. If you're still in 1 Kings, perhaps not, but if you'll turn back there to the 19th chapter. It seems to me that those who suffer discouragement often feel alone in the midst of a crowd. Elijah felt like that. He's gone down to the wilderness. He's actually, according to verse 8, gone as far as Horeb, Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. He goes into a cave there, spent the night in that place. Verse 9, behold, the word of the Lord came to him and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? So he answered, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. I'm hanging by a thread. I'm all by myself. I think that's the way people who get discouraged feel. They may be in the midst of a crowd of people who perhaps even in some cases care about them. And yet they feel like they are all alone. May I say to you that I don't believe discouragement is a sin. I believe it can quickly lead to sin. But I believe it is dangerous, and that danger lies in our response to discouragement. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to handle the valley? I'll tell you how some folks do it. They run away. Elijah did. Elijah made tracks for as far south as he could go, virtually, from Queen Isabel. Jezebel. They're not even related. Don't ask. And that's what some people do. They just feel like every once in a while they just drop everything in their life and move to another place. And they run from their difficulties. They try to run from their discouragement. They're trying to run from their problems. Sometimes it's not a geographical trek. Sometimes they just try to escape in other ways. They use drugs or alcohol is often one of the strategies used when people just get down about their circumstances in life. Isn't that sad? Because guess what happens when you sober up afterwards? Are all the problems gone? Isn't that the biggest lie that Satan can tell? If you'll just drink yourself into a stupor, it'll all be better when you wake up. Only often you don't even know what you've done while you've been in that stupor. You've hurt yourself, you've hurt other people. You waste your resources, you waste your talents, you waste your time. You waste your health, and all the problems are still there. Sometimes now exponentially larger because of alcohol or other drugs. When Elijah ran away from Jezebel, twice God asked him the same question. Verses 9 and 13, as I recall, what are you doing here? Elijah has run from the Lord, from Jezebel. The Lord didn't forbid him, the Lord didn't prevent him, but when he finally got as far away as he could, that the Lord asked him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And I think the clear implication of the question is, this is not what you're supposed to be doing. This is not where you're supposed to be. God had work for Elijah. Elijah needed to be climbing. Usually, we can't leave our problems behind. Doesn't make any difference how far you run, how fast it is that you trek. Your problems just follow along right behind. And they're still there when we stop running. Another danger of discouragement is that sometimes people allow their discouragement to make them pessimistic. And by that I mean that they adopt a worldview, a life attitude that's negative. They have a distrustful and gloomy view of everything. Congratulations, you've inherited $1 million. Oh man, the government will get most of it. It's the half empty cup all the time. And discouragement tends to create pessimistic people. That's where you can stay in the valley. You don't have to climb for the next peak. And sometimes people do. They assume that past problems are simply a guarantee of future problems. They know it. They're sure of it. And that kind of attitude is contagious. It's depressing to be around folks who are constantly pessimistic. I wonder if that's why Paul wrote what he did to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 5. Take a look, if you would, at chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians. And begin reading with me in verse 11, if you will. In verse 11 of 1 Thessalonians 5, here's what Paul encouraged the Thessalonians to do for one another. He says, "Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you also are doing." Build one another up. That's edifying. "And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake." I believe he's talking about elders there. "Be at peace among yourselves. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all." Rather than dragging you down by my own pessimistic attitude, I ought to be building you up, encouraging you, strengthening you, sustaining you when I see that you're in a valley, obviously, and not on a peak. Anybody here familiar with Murphy's Law? I think there really was a Murphy. And I'll be honest with you, I get a great deal of enjoyment out of quoting and hearing Murphy's Law. Murphy's Laws are pessimistic, aren't they? If anything bad can happen, it will happen. If you begin to think like Murphy wrote, and there's been a lot of law added to that body of law by various individuals, you will become entirely negative and pessimistic. You'll be discouraged all the time. Pessimism is like built-in discouragement. If nobody will bring it to you, you'll just carry it around with you. Often discouragement causes people to give up. That's the danger of the thing. Sometimes to quit doing even the most necessary things. Discouragement at the conduct of others is frequently the reason that young Christians give up. They were on fire and convicted and convinced that they were doing the right thing when they obeyed the gospel, but they got a look at some Christians who became like the Laodiceans, who become lukewarm, even cold, and now they themselves wonder why they're carrying on. The suicide rate in our country, unfortunately, seems to be on the rise. I wonder if prolonged discouragement doesn't play a part in that. Well, what can we do about discouragement? What I've suggested to you already is some causes for discouragement. And I've suggested to you that you will be in the valley at some point in your life, and maybe frequently, depending on the circumstances that pertain to your particular situation. But what do you do about that? Russ Bowman, D. Bowman's son, wrote something some time ago that I really think is quite insightful. He said, "Dealing with discouragement is not a matter of taking the proper action, but instead assuming the proper perspective." He said it's not which direction you're going, it's your attitude as you're down in the valley. Makes sense to me. When you're in the valley, which way can you go? Up. But you've got to have the desire, the will to do that. Let me suggest to you that the Bible is very clear about the need for a proper perspective. We read about it in Colossians, the 3rd chapter, verses 1 and 2 this morning. If you're risen with Jesus Christ, then set your mind on things above. That's your perspective. You have an entirely different perspective than the old man of sin. Webster says that the word discouraged literally is exactly what it sounds like. Discouraging somebody. It means to dishearten somebody, to lessen the courage of. It's not how courageous and brave and strong and bold you are when you're on the peak. It's how you handle it when you're down in the valley. And I'm going to suggest 4 perspective points that you need to think about. First of all, you need to look at the wider view in life. Life has its ups and downs. It's not always valleys. It's not always peaks. It's very easy to become convinced when you're down in the valley that life is going to be nothing more than just a continuous valley. And I'm never going to see anything better than what I'm seeing now. We need to understand that life tends to be a combination of the two. And what that says is I'm in a valley today, but tomorrow can very well be quite different. Perspective is so important. Do you remember the movie Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? Don't confuse that with Robin Hood, Men in Tights. All the teenagers over here. Let's get the right one. This is the one with Kevin Costner. In Kevin Costner's version of Robin Hood, he's running from his enemy. And his Islamic friend hands him a telescope, only he doesn't understand how it's to be used. And when he looks through it, his enemies appear like they're right in front of him. And he's trying to draw his sword because it looks like he's going to be... And his Islamic friend sneers at him in essence. It's a wonder you guys could do anything. Turns the thing around for him so now that he can see that they are actually quite far away. Life is like that. You have to get your perspective right. Or all of a sudden all your problems seem so large and so overwhelming and so crushing. The fact of the matter is, they're smaller than perhaps we have allowed them to grow to be in our minds. They can loom larger in our lives than is actually the case. That's perspective point number one. Look at the wider view. Understand that there's going to be ups and downs. Second one is slow down. I'm preaching to myself now. So if I'm on the front bench at the end of the sermon, somebody come up. Let me tell you what the problem is if you didn't know. We need to slow down. I'm not suggesting we ought to be lazy. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, both spiritual and I understand there are responsibilities that all of us have. We've got to stop loading ourselves. It's killing some of us. And it's really impacting the spiritual life of others. And as much as we want to excel and do the best that we can at everything, there are times when we have to say it's enough and get the adequate rest that we need. That's why there are no charts today. Because I came back from being gone a week and I had the choice of either sleeping last night or making charts. There are no charts. Slow down. Perspective point number three. Those very things that seem to be the source of discouragement for us can so often, frequently, also bring blessings. Being in prison, discouragement or blessing? Well, perspective is the difference. I want you to turn, if you will, over to the book of Philippians. Philippians is one of those books that are called the prison epistles in the New Testament, because the author Paul was in prison in Rome when it was written. And in fact, you would suspect, since he had been incarcerated for some time, even in Caesarea, and now has come to Rome and apparently has been in prison for some time there, you would think that perhaps Paul would be discouraged already over this business of being in prison. Listen to the language of Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. And incidentally, the backdrop for this particular passage and book is one of the most joyful epistles in the entire New Testament. The word rejoice, the word joy or joy, rejoicing is in this book more times than it is in any of Paul's letters. What an oddity. Listen to what he says in verse 12. But I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, so that it has become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains, but the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then, he asks? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and in this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice. Can you imagine if you were a soldier that didn't want to hear about the gospel and your job was to guard Paul? You are going to hear about it. The whole palace guard heard about it. I don't know if he's talking about the Praetorian Guard, which was incidentally a fairly large body of men, at least in the time of Augustus, when it was formed. But Paul says, prison, I'm preaching. And everybody's hearing the gospel. And my brethren are bolder to preach as they see my conduct in chains. Discouragement? Let me ask you a question. Is this a valley or a peak? Because it sure sounds like a peak, not a valley. I guess that just depends on your perspective, doesn't it? That's perspective point number three. Number four. I said to you before that when people get discouraged, and I'm hurrying along here, this is the last point. When people get discouraged, they tend to view themselves as being alone, despite the fact that sometimes they're in the midst of loving families, they're in the midst of crowds, they have isolated themselves from everybody else. And what we need to do is maintain the proper perspective, knowing that as God's child, we are never alone. David said, my friend, the person who was my sweet acquaintance, he now is against me. But David knew he could trust God, that he could turn to God, and that's why he writes Psalm 55. Pray always, pray without ceasing, Paul writes to the Philippians in chapter 5, just a little bit later on, verse 17. Don't be anxious about anything, but pray about everything, Paul wrote to the Philippians in chapter 4 and verse 6. When Joshua was getting ready to enter into the promised land, to lead the people in, he was told by Moses, by the Lord, be strong and courageous. Because the Lord knew what kind of task was ahead of him. Joshua is reminded that the Lord is with him, or would be with him. When Paul approached death in prison, apparently a different imprisonment, now here in 2 Timothy in chapter 4, listen to what Paul says in verses 16 and 17. Chapter 4, 2 Timothy, verse 16. At my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. May it not be charged against them, but the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, so that the message might be preached fully through me and that all the Gentiles might hear. Also, I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. He says, and the Lord will deliver me. He's written that he's going to die, expects to die. But as long as the Lord is with him, he'll be delivered from Satan. That is, spiritually speaking, he remains safe. I really appreciate your attention this evening. I am willing to suggest that probably there are some people here tonight who are struggling with this very problem. In an audience of this size, and with the frequency that we sometimes have our peaks and our valleys, it's quite likely that there are people here tonight who are dealing with this very problem, discouragement. And maybe for some of the same reasons that I elucidated a little bit earlier toward the beginning of the sermon. Maybe it's some other cause. But whatever the cause, what will you do about that feeling? How will you handle it? Will you run away? Will you become pessimistic? Give up? Is it possible for us to stand back and see the wider view, the big picture? Can we count our blessings, even those which seem to result from setbacks in life? Can we see that we're not alone? How will you handle your discouragements? That'll say more about you and how you handle times of success and praise and good fortune and blessings of the richest kind. The song we're going to sing in just a moment suggests there is a great day coming. And whether or not you're prepared for that great day, that day of judgment, that day of blessing for some will depend on how you deal with some of the difficulties in life. Biggest problem that people have to confront is sin in their lives. And it can thrust you in a valley so deep that you feel like you can never climb out. The fact of the matter is, you can't by yourself. There's no way that you can deal with the problem of sin and be free from the burden, from the guilt that accompanies it, unless you experience the grace of Jesus Christ. Through His blood, through the grace manifested on the cross, God can wash away all those sins and will indeed do so if you will call upon Him tonight by your obedience to the commands of the gospel. On the day of Pentecost, believers were told that they needed to repent and be baptized for the remission of their sins. That's what I will preach to you tonight. The same gospel. Because that's what will happen. You'll be forgiven of your sins in your response to the gospel offer of grace and forgiveness. We're going to take a moment here. We're going to stand and sing and invite you. And if you feel like you've been struggling against sin and losing, and you need encouragement, you've never obeyed the gospel, then why not tonight? And if you'll come to the front here so that we can be aware of your circumstances, we'll assist you in whatever way is necessary, whatever spiritual need you have. We stand to invite you. Won't you come as we stand and sing?